I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection. Nathaniel Hawthorne was always a man apart, born of blue blood but lacking the fortune. He was the sixth generation son of an old New England clan that helped settle the New World and hang Salem's witches. Hawthorne was born 200 years ago, on the 4th of July, 1804, a time when Lewis and Clark were trekking west, Thomas Jefferson was in the White House, and the American flags, bars, and stars numbered just 15 each. In the 19th century, a God-fearing America was roiled by the debate over slavery and sliding towards civil war. And there on the sidelines of it all was Hawthorne, the wary observer with the wry opinion, mining his past and surveying his present to write stories that even today seem strikingly modern. While his contemporaries and friends, Longfellow and Thoreau, Emerson and Melville, have fallen in and out of literary favor over the years, Hawthorne's writing has never lost its appeal. On this special broadcast of The Connection, we're commemorating the bicentenary of Hawthorne's birth with a conversation about his complex character and enduring classics. Now, we won't be taking any phone calls this hour, but we invite you to turn up your radio and enjoy the program. Emphasis on that invitation for our new listeners at KUNI-FM, KUNY-FM, and KRNI-AM in the state of Iowa. I'm joined in the studio now by two Hawthorne lovers. Philip McFarland is the author of Hawthorne in Concord, and Brenda Wineapple is the author of Hawthorne, A Life. Welcome to both of you. Nice to have you here.
Nice to be here. Thank you.
And happy day after 4th of July to both of you.
Well, thank you.
Brenda, let me start with you, because I find it particularly appropriate that we get a chance to talk about Hawthorne on the holiday weekend. This is not only a chance to reflect on a remarkable American writer, but one who struggled, it seems, both in his writing and in his life, with a sense of what home means, what it meant to him.
That's true. Home is a reality and a metaphor. If you think of his books, so many center on home, the House of the Seven Gables. He uses titles even that talk about our old home. It's a collection of English essays. So he was very rooted in America. Home is America. But he's uncomfortable there, too. Sometimes when I was asked why I wrote this book after writing about Paris expatriates, one of the reasons I said is that Hawthorne seemed to be an expatriate and had a very complicated sense of home. He was both very much part of Salem, of Massachusetts, of New England, but he also had one's foot out of it, which was discomforting, but gave him a terrific vision.
Now, Philip, you chose to zero in your book on Concord, on his time there. Why did you choose that location?
There's several reasons. One is the historical accident that he lived there on three different occasions at the beginning of the 1840s, the beginning of the 1850s, and the beginning of the 1860s. So by following Hawthorne through those three intervals, one can not only see the development of his career and his life, but also the dynamic changes in American history through three of the most crucial decades.
Now, he is more rooted, if I'm not mistaken, in Salem, Massachusetts, but he seems to have a falling out with that place of his birth. Is that not right?
He certainly did. The things he had to say about Salem after leaving there in 1849 were very harsh indeed. He was, Newton Arvin has said, and well said, that Hawthorne was a monk during the first part of his life and a gypsy during the latter part of it. He was never happy after an initial period in any of the places he lived, whether it was certainly Salem or Concord or Lenox or...
Lenox, the location in the Berkshires near Tanglewood years. Yeah.
Right, where he wrote The House of the Seven Gables.
He wrote to Horatio Bridge about Salem that he'd come to dislike the town, quote, so much that I hate to go into the streets or to have the people see me anywhere else. I shall at once be entirely another man. And yet, Brenda, you've decided that he in fact maintains a certain affection for Salem despite that.
Speaking of home, Salem is always home. And Hawthorne is a master of ambivalence, so that he reminds one of a Faulkner character at the end of one of the books. Quentin Compson says, I don't hate the South. I don't hate it. I don't hate it, which is Absalom, and Hawthorne could say the same about Salem. He did hate it, but he really didn't. The letter you quote from was written after Hawthorne had a very bad time at the Salem Custom House and lost his job and fought to retain it.
He lost it in a patronage scandal.
It was quite
the fuss at the time, too. The papers wrote it up and everything.
Yeah, and he participated in the papers. He wanted the papers to be part of it, and he wanted the publicity because he wanted to shame the Whigs, the party that was coming in, to get him out. But it still didn't work. And no matter how many people, and he knew a lot of people who gathered around, he still lost his job. And it was a terrible humiliation to lose your job in the town where not only you grew up, but as you said, where generations of Hawthorne's had been. So he did flee.
So when he speaks about the difficulty of being seen on the street, then it is, in your view, perhaps less a distaste for the geography, the seacoast, and more just the shame of having to live in a place where he'd endured this scandal.
Absolutely. Absolutely. It is a terrible shame to lose your job in that fashion in the public prints. But I think, I really do believe, and especially at the end of his life, that he yearned for the sea. That it didn't have to be Salem necessarily, but he yearned for the coast. He loved the coast. The coast and the ocean were very much part of his life. And in fact, interestingly enough, some of his best friends had grown up themselves on the coast. So there's something about the sea which was as alluring to him as it was to Melville in a different way.
But if Philip, he was attached to the way that people saw, if it was important to him how people saw him, how do we reconcile that with the fact that he was a lover of such solitude, so much so that even when he was living in Concord, he'd hide behind a tree if he saw someone coming in, he didn't want to say hello to them. Why did friends matter so much if he was so happy when he was alone?
He was certainly a very shy man. He had loyal friends who stood by him throughout his lifetime, a few loyal friends. I wonder how much he cared about the opinion of the Salem citizens, who, after his death, had some harsh things to say about him. I think it was anger more than shame that turned him against Salem, at the fact that the Salem people wouldn't stand up for the man that he recognized even then was going to be their most illustrious citizen.
One of the interesting things about tracking the three Massachusetts locations that we've spoken about, and Hawthorne draws our attention to this, is that one, in a way, represents the mountains, one represents the meadows, and another one represents the seashore. And he writes it at one point when he is, in Concord, that there is a peculiar quiet charm in these broad meadows and gentle eminences. They are better than mountains because they do not stamp and stereotype thoughts into the brain and thus grow wearisome with the same strong impression repeated day after day. A few summer weeks among mountains, a lifetime among green meadows and placid slopes with outlines forever new because continually fading out of memory. Such would be my sober choice. Is he fickle, do you suppose, Brenda? Because he's not really saying anything particularly flattering about the seashore. He's figuring out his place in geography, isn't he?
He's always figuring out his place in geography. I mean, that's one of the wonderful things about him. And is he fickle? I suppose we're all fickle in a certain sense. He loves where he is, and as we said, but at the same time, he also backs off from the places where he lives. And as soon as he gets someplace, after a certain amount of time, he becomes somewhat disenchanted. And a number of the places that he lived, including Concord and certainly Lenox, were places that he went to under either duress or not because he necessarily wanted to be there.
He needed money or he needed a place to stay.
Exactly. And Lenox offered him a place to stay for very low rent because friends lived nearby in the estate, which is now Tanglewood, and that he could have the little red shanty cottage there and live for next to nothing after he left Salem.
He hated that cottage.
He did hate it. It was very small. Think of it. He had a newborn baby and two children, and it was tiny, and it's very hard to write when you have that kind of space and little children around. But, of course, the environment was very beautiful and being outdoors. The winters are very hard in the Berkshires, as we all know.
Important, I suppose, though, Philip, to place this man at this time in America, because you make a point in your book that we ought not to look at Nathaniel Hawthorne's love affair or falling in and out of love with different places without looking at what was going on in the country. You make the point that America itself changed in dramatic ways in the early 19th century while he was deciding where he fit in.
That is one of the interesting aspects of dealing with Hawthorne in a particular place and then having him return to it on two other occasions to measure the changes that have occurred. In the 1840s, America was an agricultural society primarily, a commercial society, was looking eastward still toward Europe, was still fixed on perfecting itself with a lot of interest in reform in all kinds of areas, religious, peace, temperance, communitarian experiments, utopian,
transcendentalism,
and so
all that sort of
transcendentalism.
Thing.
And by the 1850s, when he returned, America's gaze had turned westward because of the Mexican War and the discovery of gold in California. It had grown much more prosperous than it was on his first visit. This affected him immediately by making his writing more lucrative. And it had focused its reform efforts on slavery.
Was he a patriot? Was this man someone who thought about the nature of the country, who wrote about it? Or was his gaze more inward on the place that he happened to occupy and the people that he was writing about?
Both. Both. He was a regionalist. His heart embraced New England, but he was very much devoted to the American experiment. In a Lincolnian way, the last best hope on earth, freed of all the encumbrances of feudalism that our English ancestors progenitors contemporaries were still struggling with. Class-free. He was very proud of all that and was very impatient with the English during the Civil War when they failed to support the North and the Northern government.
He didn't really, though, Brenda, achieve any fame or notoriety as a writer until he was in his 40s. At that time, did someone need to be seen as an American writer? We're going to take a break in a couple of minutes, so we'll get into more specifically his writing in just a moment. But what was the measure of success for a writer then? Did one need to be an American and a writer at the same time?
Well, there was a movement in America from the time of Hawthorne's birth to his maturity to get an American literature. Emerson is in the vanguard of that. Whitman is in the vanguard of that, to finally make a literature that is American. There was a British journalist, Sidney Smith, who says, you know, there is no such thing as American literature. And in some sense, all American writers coming of age in the early 19th century were taking on that as a challenge, and Hawthorne was too. But Hawthorne started his career as a short story writer, a fiction writer, and many people look down on fiction. It's not the same as we think of it today. Poetry was thought of as a very valuable enterprise, and certainly the essay. But someone like Emerson didn't really read novels or fiction. It was thought of as inferior.
Well, at one point, Hawthorne himself dismissed himself as, I am just a teller of stories.
Well, he's being somewhat ironic there. He was also being sardonic and trying to needle the people who weren't reading him. But he was underappreciated. Poe said that, who was another story writer, and recognized Hawthorne needed more.
All right, we're going to take a short break. We will come back to talk more about Nathaniel Hawthorne, who on this day is 200 years and one day old, born July 4th, 1804. I'm Dick Gordon. You're listening to a special holiday edition of The Connection. I'm Dick Gordon. You're listening to a special holiday edition of The Connection. With me in the studio today, Philip McFarlane, author of Hawthorne in Concord. Brenda Wineapolis here. She's author of Hawthorne, A Life. So guess what we're talking about. 200 years ago this weekend, Nathaniel Hawthorne was born in Salem, Massachusetts. We're marking his bicentenary. And I thought what we could do is listen to a little bit of the very beginning of the novel that most of us know so well, The Scarlet Letter. This one read in 1965 in a Kedman Records recording by none other than Basil Rathbone.
A throng of bearded men in sad-colored garments and gray steeple-crowned hats, intermixed with women, some wearing hoods and others bareheaded, was assembled in front of a wooden edifice, the door of which was heavily timbered with oak and studded with iron spikes. The founders of a new colony, whatever utopia of human virtue and happiness they might originally project, have invariably recognized it among their earliest practical necessities to allot a portion of the virgin soil as a cemetery and another portion as the site of a prison.
Certainly it is. Philip McFarland, some thoughts from you on just hearing that man's voice reading that prose is sort of compelling.
Isn't that a lovely combination? The dulcet tones, the rich tones of Basil Rathbone reading that gorgeous, gorgeous prose. One of the things that would attract any modern reader to Hawthorne, surely, is that he never wrote, as far as I can recollect, an awkward sentence.
And, was it a hit the year it was published, 1850?
It certainly was. Uh-huh. A hit in that sold well. It never made much money for him in his lifetime, but it was not a hit the way some other popular writings of the time or of that decade would prove to be hits. But it was, for Hawthorne, a remarkable success right off.
It gave him such standing, I guess, Brenda, among his literary peers?
He already had standing among his literary peers, but it gave him a much wider audience, also because the book was somewhat scandalous, don't forget. In a sense, too, there were some argument about Hester Prynne. It's the story of a single mother, what we today call a single mother, raising her child on her own, and a pious reverend who is the secret father of the child, so that it's a story really of adultery and feminism in a way, and of course so that raised certain feathers for Hawthorne, which of course helps sell books.
Were these scandalous topics to approach at that time? Were people writing about adultery? Were people, I mean, I don't know if there was any character like Hester Prynne before her in American literature. She has such strength of character, such sexual self-confidence.
And such stature that she still is on the American stage. She enters into our imagination in a way unlike any other, I think, heroine, certainly of the 19th century, probably of the 20th century. And in point of fact, she is magisterial and powerful and, as you say, sexy, sensual, and smart. So she's a very unusual figure in that sense, and created by a man. So that's very unusual as well.
He was no great fan of women writers of his time, was he, Philip?
No, he was not. Notoriously not.
I mean, just before we make him a complete metrosexual of the 19th century.
No, Hawthorne is a child of his time, of course, and one of his convictions, which he shared with many others, was that it was indecorous of women to write, to speak in public. They might as well walk down the street naked. And when James T. Fields approached him to have Sophia, who wrote beautifully herself, travel accounts, descriptive materials for the Atlantic, Hawthorne put his foot down. He had said that her accounts of their times in England were more vivid than his own, but he wasn't about to permit his wife to publish. So he had ambivalent feelings about...
Was he threatened by women?
Was he threatened by women? He was threatened by most people. That's why he kept to himself. He said to Sophia at one point, "I have always been more comfortable alone than in anybody else's company except with you."
I want to read a little something, Brenda, from your book, because it stuck in my mind. This is a description of the man's writing style, if you permit me. "With an insight so fine it bordered on the voluptuous, he crafted a style of exquisite ambiguity, of uncompromising passion and stubborn skepticism. Yet his characters are often curiously static, poised between self-knowledge and indifference, and, like Hawthorne himself, confounded by what and who they are. For Hawthorne was a man of dignity, of mordant wit, of malicious anger, a man of depression and control, a forthright and candid man, aching to confess, but too proud, too obstinate, too ashamed to do so, a man of disclosure and disguise, both at once keen, cynical, intelligent, who digs into his imagination to write of American men and women, isolated in their communities, burdened by their history, riven by their sense of crime and their perpetual befuddled innocence." I'm struck by his by your zeroing in on his ability to find those people in their places. Because in many ways, that's his art, isn't it? That while we spoke earlier about his sense of place, he has no difficulty writing about the psychology of place and the psychology of the people in the same breath, at the same time. It was almost as if, in his own way, he discovered that for American literature.
Yes, you can see why Henry James loved Hawthorne as the direct inheritor. And he said that Hawthorne had a cat-like ability of seeing in the dark. And in a sense, what he's saying is that he has a psychological insight, the likes of which few authors have. And James certainly, as a young man, aspired to it. He actually cried the day Hawthorne died. And I think, you know, go back to the question about women, there's a way in which Hawthorne identified with women as outcasts, even though, as Philip says, his attitude was sometimes and thought to be a little bit nervous about women writing. But I think he identified with women. He knew feminists like Margaret Fuller and admired them. If he was hesitant or didn't want his wife to write, it was not just that he was threatened by them, but he was threatened by his own feelings toward them. And, of course, he hadn't been able to be a success until fairly late in his life himself. So he knew what it meant to be an outsider, to feel on the outside of things, to be a member of an aristocratic class in Salem, but to have had that aristocracy not only fall from grace because of the witchcraft delusion, but also lose its money. And so he always had, as I said before, a vantage point that's both inside and outside. And one of his great gifts is to be able to translate that into human psychology, our motives being mixed, and then to create beautiful sentences that double back on themselves so that you can always read them two, three, four times.
He spent, if I'm not mistaken, Philip, some 12 years almost completely alone in Salem in the years before he married Sophia. It was a time... Now, stop me if I get this wrong. You're the scholar, not me. But there was a long period of time when he lived as a virtual hermit, was there not?
From 1825 to about 1837, so that does come to the 12 years that you mentioned. And he was learning to write, and he wrote and he wrote and he wrote. He burned a great deal of what he wrote, but his dedication was fierce, and he was publishing the acceptable results, as he judged them, anonymously in various newspapers around New England. They were eventually gathered together in book form.
Did he use
Twice
the same
Told
pseudonym?
Tales.
Oh, yeah, okay.
Twice Told Tales, and he used his own name there. He didn't use a pseudonym. They were published anonymously originally, so that all that time of the 12 years of writing, he was not developing a reputation because nobody knew who had written it. And he claimed that his stories had made provoked not a single bit of reaction, as far as he was ever made aware. It's interesting, though, those 12 years of isolation, a word that Brenda used in that passage you just read, prepares him, I think, to speak to the 20th century and the 21st century better, perhaps, than some of his contemporaries who were more communally oriented, people like Dickens. Emily Dickinson, for example, was another isolate. Melville was a third. And these people seem to speak to our own alienated age more effectively, perhaps, than some of their contemporaries.
A very close association between Herman Melville and Nathaniel Hawthorne. Some people say that Moby Dick would not be the book that it is had it not been for Nathaniel Hawthorne providing that kind of feedback for the young Melville at the time. Is that right, Brenda?
I think there's probably a lot of truth in that. Melville read Mosses from an Old Manse, an early a second collection of Hawthorne's stories, and he was completely bowled over, both by the stories themselves and then secondly by meeting Hawthorne, who by that time was in Lenox, and Melville was living nearby in Stockbridge. And when Melville read Hawthorne, he thought, here's the American Shakespeare, like me. This is the person I want to become.
No shortage of ego among the writers.
No. Well, certainly not in Melville at this time, because he was a best-selling author, which, in point of fact, Actually, Hawthorne hadn't been. Hawthorne had only published the successful Scarlet Letter, but actually during the so-called isolated period you and Philip were talking about, which I don't believe he was that isolated during, he wrote a novel then, too, called Fanshawe, that he later pretended he hadn't written. So he was writing this entire time and feeling somewhat neglected. And here was Melville, younger, again, a person who had taken to the sea, and who understood him, who said, I know what you're doing, and I'm going to do it, too. And so it was a very fast friendship at this particular time in Lenox, where they both felt, again, like outsiders.
Take us a little further with this questioning about the solitude, though, because it's part of the Hawthorne myth. And if there's questions about it, I'd like to know what they are.
Oh, dear. Well, you know, the interesting thing about myths is, first of all, they die hard. And no matter what you say or what you prove, people want to believe them.
You mean he didn't grow up in the House of Seven Gables?
No, he didn't grow up in the House of Seven Gables. But the interesting thing about this so-called secluded period is partly we think it's secluded because there's not as much correspondence documenting it as there is other periods. But he lived with his two sisters and his mother. There were other relatives from his mother's side in the family at that particular time. He was still very close with his Bowdoin associates, who had mainly gone into politics. He visited them back and forth. He took lots of trips. He traveled both through New England and New York State. He was thinking of going on a South Sea expedition. So he's very active during this particular period of time, writing, as Philip said, a great deal, and actually even having a love affair, at least one or two we know about, and who knows how many others. So it's actually very interesting. It's hard to document, because later Hawthorne helped craft the myth of being isolated, neglected, a kind of recluse and a hermit, which kept him protected in a way. It's a good way to keep people distant, or at least the people you want to keep
distant. Don't go into those years, nothing happened.
Right, exactly. Exactly. So we wonder what he's hiding, and that's something else people always wonder about. What was his secret? Because he writes books about secrets.
Do we give him credit then, Philip, with having a remarkable imagination? I'm thinking of the way that he describes relationships in stories like Young Goodman Brown, where not a lot happens, but you are drawn right through this short story of a man who simply goes for a walk in the woods some night. Does that come purely from the man's imagination? How do you see that?
I certainly do see it that way, that his imagination was a formidable instrument, and that when he wrote from his imagination, he wrote brilliantly. When he wrote from his experience, when he created fiction from his experience, it tended to be less effective, as he did about his time in Brook Farm. He wrote a novel, The Blithedale Romance, which is not, to a modern reader at least, as successful by any means as the as his two preceding novels. He's at his best using his imagination. He could write only 2 or 3 hours a day. If he tried to write more than that, he detected a deterioration in his work, and so he wouldn't go on. He wouldn't write in the summertime. He would brood and brood, and when it came time actually to set the prose down, that glorious prose he wrote, he did it rather rapidly. It was not so much that he labored over the prose. He did labor in a posture that didn't look like laboring, strolling on a beach or sitting in a room. He labored over the conception, over the imagining of what he was going to write.
So, Brenda, where's the real Nathaniel Hawthorne? Because if you have this sort of wild, dark imagination that there's a story that you draw my attention to. I'd not read it before. Is it Mr. or Mrs. Wakefield?
Just Wakefield.
Wakefield, okay.
Just Wakefield.
This is about a man who leaves his wife, lives around the corner for 20 years.
20 years, and watches her, wants to know if she misses him, you know, and at the end goes back. It's one of the strangest stories you'll ever read, and Hawthorne is wonderful at those strange kinds of stories. And again, that's a story of a kind of a homegrown expatriate who is a spectator as well, who's always watching things and is in
more
some
wants
sense,
to watch than participate.
Or wants to watch,
yeah.
Wants to see. I mean, one way you can read that story is, will you love me when I'm gone? You know, how much do you really, really love me? But at the same time, We read it almost in what we'd call 20th century existential way. What is it like to suddenly slip out of our world, to go around the block? Will things continue on without us? And do we need to sort of stay in routine and patterns in order to keep ourselves sane? So it raises all kinds of questions like that, and it doesn't answer them at all.
But if we look at his relationship with Sophia, mm-hmm. and, I mean, it is illustrated by these fantastic love letters. He is able to express the sort of coming together of those two hearts in remarkable language. Do you buy that? Is that the real Hawthorne?
Oh, I think there are many Hawthornes. There are many of all of us, I should hope. We don't want to think that there's just one of us. And Hawthorne was blessed with a very happy marriage for most of his life. He found someone who was enormously supportive, a tremendous booster, as was her entire family. And he was, especially at the outset of the relationship, deeply in love and created a kind of world for himself that was, I think, very conducive to continuing working as he did. He was a man of tremendous passion. Again, the myth of the recluse dies hard. He had passionate feelings about his children, about his wife, and about his friends, too.
Good and evil figured very prominently, Philip, in those imaginings and his writings. It's one almost direct line from the times we live today to the times that he lived or imagined at his time. Was he trying to figure out the difference between the two, or just trying to find the words to help describe that? How would you put that?
About evil, I think he was just fascinated by it. The fact that evil lives in every human heart. Every human heart. It may remain latent throughout a lifetime, if you're lucky, but some circumstance may bring it forth. And he gives an example. He's writing now in his notebooks ideas for tales that he might develop. Evil dwells in every human heart, latent perhaps, but circumstances may bring it forth to consider these circumstances. A woman on a whim decides to be unfaithful to her husband, or a young man wants to taste blood, so commits murder. And that's the end of the entry. But it certainly is an indication of the sort of thematic concerns that make Hawthorne relevant today in the wake of My Lai and Abu Ghraib.
Brenda Wineapple calls him the master of concealment. This hour we're talking about Nathaniel Hawthorne on the 200th anniversary of his birth on this special holiday edition of The Connection. I'm Dick Gordon. I'm Dick Gordon. You're listening to The Connection from National Public Radio, an opportunity to explore some of the people and the places in the mind of Nathaniel Hawthorne, perhaps the best American novel writer, certainly the best of his time. Literary people still argue about exactly where he fits, but he still fits, and that's the key. 200 years after his birth, we're still talking about him. We're still studying his work. This is a special holiday edition of The Connection, so you don't have to pick up your telephone to join the conversation. Just sit back and enjoy. And I thought what we could do is enjoy a little bit more of the writing of Mr. Hawthorne. This, the opening passage, again read by Basil Rathbone, 1966 Cadman Records recording, the opening passage of Young Goodman Brown.
Young Goodman Brown came forth at sunset into the street at Salem Village, but put his head back after crossing the threshold to exchange a parting kiss with his young wife. And Faith, as the wife was aptly named, thrust her own pretty head into the street, letting the wind play with the pink ribbons of her cap, while she called to Goodman Brown. Dearest heart, whispered she, softly and rather sadly, when her lips were close to his ear, prithee, put off your journey until sunrise and sleep in your own bed tonight. A lone woman is troubled with such dreams and such thoughts that she's afeard of herself sometimes. Pray tarry with me this night, dear husband, of all nights in the year. My love.
Young Goodman Brown, the writing of none other than Nathaniel Hawthorne. Brenda Wineapple, He wrote so bloody well, didn't he?
He did. Everything, even his letters, are beautifully written. You know, and the interesting thing about Hawthorne, if you're interested in his style, it really seems to arrive on the scene full-blown. I mean, his early writings are really exquisite, and this is one of the earlier ones, and they're just as beautiful as his later ones.
Is it his power of description? Is the way he uses words? You talked earlier about the way he'll get a sentence to turn back on itself, but mm-hmm. Just listening to that, and I was reading it as well, he sets a scene so clearly you can't help but see those pink ribbons flying in the wind.
That's absolutely true. His powers of description are paramount, and then he has an ability to set psychology, set people in motion in those places, so both come very, very much alive. And he's very close to language and words, so that he knows what he's choosing at every single moment, so that he's able to involve the reader very, very quickly with a style that really is, in a sense, an 18th century style.
Now, before we leave that one passage, yeah. Brenda, a word from you about good and evil, because one of the most interesting parts of the way that young Goodman Brown begins is that we know almost in the first few sentences that something horrible is going to happen, and all we have is a young man saying goodbye to his wife on the street of Salem.
Ah, but she says if she wants him to stay with her that night, and her name is Faith, and he doesn't stay, and they're only 3 months married. So where is he going? He's going to the woods. You know, it's a Dante-ish kind of woods, and Herman Melville said that Hawthorne was deep as Dante, and those woods are deep as Dante. So he has an appointment somewhere. Everyone wants to wander. And that sort of gets us into the story, whether we identify with Faith, which we probably don't, or with Goodman Brown. And so he wants to experiment. And what he finds there is that there is a kind of evil, corruption, failure, let's call it fallibility, in himself that he really can't deal with. And that's what the journey becomes all about. And he thinks he's looking for goodness. But he's really looking for something else. And it's very difficult to confront the fact that we may not be as good as we think we are. So Hawthorne always mixes pain and pleasure, good and evil, because he sees us as limited.
I wonder, Philip, if taking this one step beyond the man's remarkable imagination, he is able to describe that little bit of evil that lives in him as well. Maybe that's why it's persuasive, is that when he describes that, we know that what he's speaking is true.
It certainly rings true, doesn't it? And it has the authenticity of something that he's felt deeply himself. It's interesting that early on at the old manse, in the midst of those early days of his extraordinarily happy marriage, a near-perfect marriage, he would conceive the story, The Birthmark, and write it, which is about a man who is married to an almost perfect woman, but she has one little blemish, and he sets out to remove it and, of course, kills her by doing so, not being content with the near perfection he has. That Hawthorne would be brooding about such a thing in those circumstances is highly suggestive to me, and yet the story is so rich in meaning, as so much of Hawthorne is. It's a story about the artist working with imperfect materials to create perfection. Is it about abortion? Is it about... There are just so many different interpretations of what this simple episode is about. Aylmer, the scientist who works this awful thing upon his wife to remove the tiny little birthmark, a monster of evil, or is he a noble being aspiring to perfection, as his wife seems to say on her, as his wife says on her deathbed, you have striven nobly, don't reproach yourself, this is what you should have done. It's that ambiguity again of Hawthorne and that richness. It's interesting, if I may just take one second more about young Goodman Brown. I'm not sure Hawthorne himself always knew the worth of what he had done. When he set about to anthologize his stories in 1837 in Twice Told Tales, he skipped young Goodman Brown, didn't include it, even though he had written it in the early 30s. And then when he put together Mosses from an Old Match, he still didn't include it. And it, by that time, this was 1846, he'd had plenty of time to include it. It wasn't until The Snow Image in 1851 that he finally included Young Goodman Brown. And commentators in the 19th century paid very little attention to that story. And now we consider it perhaps the summit of his achievement.
I want to turn the page to back a little bit to an understanding of the man in his time and his place. Brenda, you spoke earlier about his Bowdoin colleagues. One of them was Henry Wadsworth Longfellow. The other one was Franklin Pierce, who would go on to become president of the United States.
14th president.
And he asked...
And forgotten.
Not completely.
By
the people in New Hampshire.
No. And it's his bicentennial year this year, so
we should
wish Franklin Pierce a happy birthday while we're wishing Hawthorne a happy birthday.
He asked his friend, Nathaniel, to do him a favor. What was that?
Pierce asked...
Yeah, he asked for a little bit of writing from Mr. Hawthorne.
Well, Hawthorne also volunteered.
Did he? Oh, sure.
It was a mutual decision. Actually, Hawthorne wanted to write the campaign biography for Franklin Pierce. These two men had been, as you said, friends since Bowdoin days, where they first met. And Franklin Pierce had a meteoric, really, political career. And by the time he got into the White House, he was helped by Hawthorne, who by 1852, when Pierce was elected, was already known as one of the preeminent authors of the United States. Hawthorne wrote a campaign biography that Pierce's detractors called Hawthorne's latest romance. And it's probably...
Is there any good writing in it? I didn't.
Yeah, there. You know, it depends on how you look at style. I mean, sentence by sentence, again, this is Hawthorne crafting wonderful sentences that loop around each other, you know, long with, you know, all kinds of independent clauses and quite beautiful. But it's... But it is a romance, and it's the romance of Franklin Pierce. And it was funny. I think there was a review of it in the Times, and the Times said that New York Times said, unbeknownst to Hawthorne, Pierce comes off as a mediocrity in this, even in this book. But it didn't hurt. Pierce won by a landslide.
And the one thing that Hawthorne did in helping write this, or in writing this biography for Franklin Pierce, Philip, was that he put in writing a position, his position or Pierce's position on slavery, which I think in the language of the mid-19th century was to say, I support the Constitution, which was a way of saying, I support the South's right, the Southern states' rights to, you know, continue on with slavery. It got him in an enormous amount of difficulty with his fellow writers and other New Englanders, didn't it?
It did indeed. It was clear from the writing that Hawthorne was sympathetic to Pierce's devotion to the Union and pledged to enforce the Constitution, which sanctioned slavery. Hawthorne had no use for slavery. He didn't know much about slavery. Slavery was something that was taking place at a great distance from where he was. He was a New Englander.
But all his friends and colleagues were abolitionists, and it wasn't as if it didn't exist.
This is true enough. They had much more experience with living among blacks, for example. Harriet Beecher Stowe had grown up in a family where there were black people working, and Hawthorne's experience was very slight on this issue, and he was mistrustful of reformers in any case. This effort by human beings to alter God's plan as it was unfolding, he was too much puritanical in his inheritances to have much faith in
part of the belief that there was a color scale in God's plan. I mean, that was
very much is part of it, and that this scourge of slavery will be removed providentially in God's good time.
Does it, though, Brenda, exist as a stain on the man's latter years as a writer? I mean, it hurt him among his friends?
Not really. I mean, his friends were... didn't like Pierce, but a lot of, you know, his friends ran a gamut of opinion also. I mean, the abolitionists at one extreme, some were anti-slavery, some supported John Brown. I mean, so that there was, but not all of them were abolitionists, and a lot of them had opinions that evolved. The interesting thing about Hawthorne is that he was writing about slavery in 1835. He was writing about it early. He in the 1840s, he had another friend from Bowdoin, a man named Horatio Bridge. I think you read his letter before. And he worked with Horatio Bridge on a book called The Journal of an African Cruiser, which basically, in the book, what Hawthorne and Bridge were saying is that they supported colonization, which was the deportation of emancipated blacks, emancipated slaves, to a place called Liberia, which the president of Liberia was then another Bowdoin classmate. In any case, at the same time, in this particular time, especially in the 1830s, before the book came out, Abraham Lincoln supported a colonization. Abraham Lincoln's own feelings about slavery evolved. Hawthorne's changed somewhat, but not to the extent that we who love Lincoln or want him to be Frederick Douglass changed. And he definitely supported the Constitution. He supported Franklin Pierce, but he did not support the fugitive slave law. And people so loved Hawthorne, his friends, whatever, Emerson, Longfellow, that they figured that it must have been Hawthorne was naive, he didn't know much about history, and Franklin Pierce bamboozled him.
So where does he rest then, Philip? We're near the end of the program. Where does he sit in your mind as an American writer? I struggled earlier to say he's the major novelist. He's this. He's that. He's 200 years old this weekend. How do we regard him today?
Among 19th century novelists, certainly one of the two or three greatest. I don't think anyone would dispute that. Melville would certainly be in the running. I'm not always comfortable with hierarchical arrangements like this, but I take your point, and I want to repeat a point you made at the beginning, that unlike so many American writers, Melville included, Hawthorne was highly esteemed at his death, and every succeeding generation has continued to esteem him highly. That's not true of Thoreau. That's not true, certainly, of Longfellow, of all the trinomial, James Russell Lowell, Oliver Wendell Holmes.
For a last word from Brenda. What did he leave us? What is his literary legacy, as you see it?
Think of him as 200 years young. Think of Paul Auster. Think of John Updike, Toni Morrison, William Faulkner, Bharti Mukherjee, Susan Laurie Parks. These are all the children of Hawthorne. And keep him very much alive for us today when we celebrate him.
Well, I tell you, you guys have brought him very much to life for
us today.
On the program. Brenda, I want to thank you so much for coming in. It's nice to have you here.
Appreciate it. Thank
Brenda
you.
Brenda Wineapple is author of Hawthorne, A Life, and Philip McFarland. It's been great to have you on the program
thank
as well.
You. I've enjoyed being here.
Philip is author of Hawthorne in Concord. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection.